KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Tuesday, June 21st, 2005, for broadcast at this time. Today's guest speaker will be Thomas Gutierrez, Director of Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and Dean of International Studies and Programs at UNO. Mr. Gutierrez is making his second appearance at the Omaha Press Club. His topic will be Afghanistan Revisited. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Kerr.
Good afternoon. I'm Gary Kerr, chairman of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee. Each month, the Education Committee sponsors a noon forum involving a person or subject we think will be of interest to our members and the general public. Our noon forums are open to the public. You do not have to be a Press Club member to attend. It's been almost 4 years now since the September 2001 attack on the World Trade Center in New York and U.S. retaliation against terrorists operating out of Afghanistan. Shortly after the U.S. attack, UNO's Tom Gutierrez was here for a noon forum in which he was generally upbeat about the future for Afghanistan. How does he feel today? We are going to find out. Tom Gutierrez is Dean of International Studies and Programs at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and an internationally recognized authority on Afghanistan and surrounding countries. He is Director of Afghanistan Studies at UNO. Before coming to UNO in 1974, he lived and worked for nearly 10 years in Afghanistan, where he served as a Peace Corps volunteer, a Fulbright Fellow, and Executive Director of the Fulbright Foundation. He has been back to Afghanistan many times. Tom will speak for about 30 minutes, and then he will take your questions. There is paper and pencil at your table. Please write down your question, and it will be brought to me to ask from the podium. So please join me now in welcoming Tom Gutierrez.
I kind of like to walk around a little bit when I speak. I think it's part of being a teacher as well, and I'm nervous when I'm teaching, and so I have to kind of walk around the classroom, and so I'm going to do the same thing here. I'm really pleased to be here. I'm pleased because I see so many familiar and friendly faces. It's always nice to see a familiar and friendly audience. I'd like you to lock that door, though, because I also like a captive audience. If you take care of that, I'm just teasing, really. because I never speak in fewer than 30 minutes, so if Gary thinks that I'm going to get this thing done on time, he's woefully misled. But I'll try, Gary. I know you guys used to function on the minute there on TV, but I expect my students to stay after class at UNO. So I'm always pleased to talk about Afghanistan, and I'm always pleased to talk about Afghanistan because I have had so many wonderful memories in a country that has gone through so many difficult times. And most of us were not very familiar with Afghanistan at all until it went through those horrible times, first when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan and at Christmas time of 1979, then again when the Soviets left Afghanistan on Valentine's Day in 1989, and then, of course, when all the events that surrounded 9/11 occurred, so that we wound up focusing in on Afghanistan again, wondering what it was that this country had done or why it was involved in those 9/11 attacks. We found out, of course, is that Afghanistan had been hijacked by the nation of Pakistan and its military and its allies, the Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden-led terrorists, and by, of course, the Taliban clients that the Pakistani military had kind of created. And Pakistan was that way, in other words, paranoid. The reason why Pakistan has always been so paranoid of India is because India has fought with Pakistan three different major wars. And everything that Pakistan thinks about is in a focus to its east, an east that has the Pakistanis really apprehensive about whether or not the Indians, again, are going to be asserting themselves. And in each of these wars, the Pakistanis have come off very, very poorly. And so it wanted to make sure when the Soviets left Afghanistan that whatever was left in Afghanistan was not in any way going to be an impediment to Pakistan's regional objectives, regional interests. And Pakistan saw a real opportunity with the Soviet Union leaving Afghanistan because they now knew for sure that these Russians were not going to be able to march to the Indian Ocean as Tsar Peter the Great had suggested they should as their manifest destiny while they were seeking that warm water port which has always been denied them. You know, if you take a look today at Russia, you'll see that its major ports are either St. Petersburg or Murmansk on the west, which are always in danger of being frozen over, or Vladivostok on the east, same thing, or they have a new port now in the Black Sea to the east of the Crimea, which now has reverted to Ukraine. But that warm water port in the Black Sea only leads them to exit through the Bosporus, which is controlled by Turkey and the NATO troops. And so Russia doesn't have a way to get out. So it now understood that, you know, it was kind of landlocked in that way, cold water port-wise, for its long term. And Pakistanis understood that. Pakistanis also understood that the newly independent states in Central Asia, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, all north of Afghanistan, newly independent states with no history of democratic process and locked in by that Iron Curtain in the past, we're now going to look elsewhere to move their goods and get connections with the rest of the world. They were tired of having to do everything that they did through the Russians or through the Soviet Union, which was, of course, dominated by the Russians. So the Pakistanis understood that, and they knew that the quickest way to get to the for these Central Asian republics to get to the Indian Ocean was through Afghanistan and Pakistan. And so they wanted to make sure they're going to have an opening there. They also wanted to make sure, since all these newly independent states were at least nominally Muslim, along with Afghanistan, that they would have a kind of strategic Islamic depth to their west, because they knew to their east that in India they had, you know, this potential enemy. And we know, of course, follow that in the news today. We're very much concerned about the fact that Pakistan and India each has nuclear weapons, and you know, they're pointed at each other. And if they ever go to war with each other with these weapons, it will have an impact not just on them, but also on all of us around the world, and particularly in that region, which is very, very vital to us. Again, with this map, you can see where India and Pakistan is located, right next to Afghanistan. And you also notice that between Afghanistan and Iraq, the two countries that are most in our news today, is Iran, which is also very much in our news, particularly with these elections and, of course, in our past. And these three countries are very, very integral to how it is that the United States is going to best ensure its interest in that part of the world. And we have to make sure that in looking forward to our presence in that part of the world, we're going to be able to deal with these three countries. Because if we look just south of Iran and Iraq, we notice, of course, the Persian Gulf, which has so many of the petrochemical resources. And then we look just north of Iran, and we see the Caspian Basin, which is the second largest repository of petrochemical resources in the world. And we know that this is very important since we are the first user of these resources. We use nearly 30% of the world's energy resources with our very, very small percentage of the world's population. So these are important to our long-term future, and we see, of course, that Afghanistan, in any map, will point you right to the center of that part of the world, like Omaha, Nebraska, is right at the very center of the United States. And it's not only central because of where it's located, but we'll see that Afghanistan was always very, very important as a crossroads in Asia. We now hear of Afghanistan, but it's important for us to remember that it was the very, very center part of the old Silk Road. And that goes back 5,000 years, the Silk Road of ancient history. And people were traveling from China to Egypt, you know, thousands of years ago. They were going through Afghanistan. Then there's a spice route coming out of India, coming up through Afghanistan, joining the Silk Road. And they came together in Samarkand in what is present-day Uzbekistan, and they went west and east with all of their goods. One of the things that we hear about in the news today is that there's a new thing with King Tut, and there's a new exhibit, and we're talking about what he really looked like, and we found out that he wasn't murdered, apparently. But how many of you, and I suspect many of you, have been to Egypt? And if you've been to Egypt, you've been to the Cairo Museum. And if you've been to the Cairo Museum, the most famous exhibit there is King Tut and his sarcophagus. Gold, beautiful. And it's covered with lapis lazuli stones. Those lapis lazuli stones came from Afghanistan, and they went all the way over to Egypt. And we're talking about more than 3,000 years ago. And so that gives you an idea of the way these caravans were traveling and how many years ago. And then we take a look at any map, and we see, of course, again, where Afghanistan's located. And then we go far to the west to where Macedonia is and Greece is. And remember that 3,000 years before the Christian era, we had Alexander moving out of that part of the world, coming all the way to the Indus River in what is today Pakistan, going down the Indus and back up through the Arabian Sea and the Persian Gulf to what was then Babylon, where he died at 32, and there's hardly any of us here that young, so we know that that if we're trying to compare ourselves in terms of our success with Alexander, we've all lost the major battle. But here he had conquered all of that world that you see on that map, and of course, he used to do that with all these soldiers, and each of those soldiers had one or two servants. And think of him moving 16,000 or more soldiers from place to place and with all those servants. It's like moving Bellevue, Nebraska, every time you had to go from one battle to the next. It's no wonder that the Latin word for baggage, and I know that Jack Newton knows what that is, right? It is impedimenta, huh? Impedimenta, impediment, all right? I'm putting you on the spot, Jack, so you better be ready with these. Right. Well, most of everything about you is rather old, Jack, but not just your Latin. But in any case, impediment is the obvious, meaning of baggage. Can you think of moving 3,300 years ago, all those people through a place like Afghanistan, coming out of Greece, and then conquering that part of the world? Well, anyhow, I offer that as a kind of perspective for you that brings Afghanistan back to your attention in terms of the fact that though it may have come to our attention only recently, Afghanistan has been integral to the passage of humankind throughout history. There have been movements of Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus and caravans laden with silk and gold and lapis lazuli and all other kinds of treasures that have been passing through this part of the world. Little question then why Afghanistan was referred to as the crossroads of Asia. Why people in Pakistan and India thought that their future was very much dependent upon how things were able to move, and why they call the mountains of Afghanistan Hindu Kush, which means Hindu cook killer. Huh? Remember that the Mughal dynasty of India came out of Central Asia, set up its capital in Kabul, Afghanistan, then moved down into India eventually to build the Taj Mahal, which probably many of you have also seen and rightfully regard as perhaps the most beautiful building ever constructed by humankind, and had a very, very long-term dynasty, the Mughals of India, until the British took over for them. But anyhow, when you get a chance, go back and take a look and start looking again at Afghanistan through that kind of perspective. But I'd also like us to take a look at another perspective. And I'm going to use this map of Iraq. And I'm going to use these sections of Iraq to help us to get a good sense of what I'm going to be talking about next. You'll see in the upper left there where the where Iraq is divided into three sections. In the north by the Sunni Kurds, in the middle with the Sunni Arabs, and in the south there with the and at the bottom with the Shia Arabs. And just to point that out, you know, here we got three different parts of Iraq. There are more parts, by the way, of Iraq than just three, but these are the three particular parts that we hear about, and we hear about in terms of ethnic diversity, which is a positive word in a society of like ours, at least politically correctly, it's positive. But in other parts of the world, that kind of diversity often lies at the heart of the long-term struggles and conflicts that exist there, just like they existed in Europe. Europe, we tend to forget, was a collection of tribes, the French and the Germans and within those countries, the Anglos and the Saxons and the Jutes and all these others, the Bavarians and the Czechs and the Bohemians and the Moravians, and wherever you went. And people identified themselves by their tribal connection. And Europe had all these many, many wars over many, many centuries, over language and ethnicity and religion, the Protestants and the Catholics within the Christian Church, and of course the persecution of Jews. And we you know, it's easy when we reflect a little bit back to remember how these kinds of things dominated Europe's history. Well, in every part of the world, generally, where people don't come new to the land like so many have in the United States, that's the same situation where people live in the same land that their great-grandfathers, great-grandfathers, great-grandfathers lived, and where everybody identifies him or herself by his or her property and his family or her family's property. Well, in this part of the world, well, we hear so much about Iraq. We know of the differences between the Sunni Arabs and the Shia Arabs, and yet we don't often hear so much about the Sunni Kurds. It's important to remember that when you take a look at the world, it's important to remember this, that the parts of all of these countries are touched by other countries in which there's a lot of blending over of people's ethnicities, and particularly in Kurdistan, this kind of hoped-for state someday in the minds of all Kurds. Kurds live in Iraq, Syria, Iran, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Turkey. And they'd love nothing better than to see a Kurdistan, just like an Uzbekistan or an Afghanistan. But they don't have that. And so they're kind of playing all cards that they can in Iraq. But the thing for us to important to remember is they're not Arabs. And when we take a look at any map and we take a look at Iraq, generally the Mesopotamian Valley is where the Arab world is separated to the east from the rest of the world that we often call the Middle East, even in Iran and Afghanistan and certainly South Asia, and that the largest Muslim countries in the world aren't anywhere near the Middle East. They're Indonesia, Bangladesh, India, and Pakistan, none of which are Arab. It's important for us to remember this difference, and that when we take a look again at Iraq and we take a look again at other countries in that part of the world, we need to remember what those ethnic differences are, how people think. It's going to color all their thinking. And the final point on this lead-in is that, remember this, that the greatest part of Iraq's population, 60%, is inhabited by the people in the green section, the Shia Arab section, who never have been in control of their country, but they are the majority. The Sunni Arabs only constitute about 20% of the country, and the rest of the country in the north, essentially, the Sunni Kurds. So now you have a situation. We're trying to bring democracy to Iraq, and we're trying to put upon them this practice of democracy. And, of course, majorities rule in democracies. Well, that's also an issue in Afghanistan, which is also divided up very, very deeply by ethnic differences. They're not as severe in Afghanistan, though there have been problems there over the past, as they are in Iraq, because they've had periods, even a democratic period in the 60s and 70s, where they've had opportunities to experiment with trying to make themselves work together. There are no discussions today about Afghanistan coming apart, and there are issues, even a potential for a civil war, that people talk about in Iraq. Remember how smoothly those elections went in Afghanistan last year? Everybody was following that, and people had a lot of apprehension about that. But they went even more smoothly than I think people thought they could. And part of the reason is that Afghans have had the opportunity to practice democracy before in the 60s and 70s. They had two previous democratic elections. They were parliamentary elections under a constitutional monarchy, but indeed they were democratic. And so Afghans have always believed that's their legacy. Even those who were born after those events, that's their history, and they believe that that's what they should have. And so they were able to have that happen. That was a very important step for them. And, of course, we know that during those elections, an individual who recently visited Omaha, Hamid Karzai, was chosen president. And that was a very, very major step for Afghanistan, and one now that he has, you know, a role that now that has brought him to the point where he's trying to find ways to bring all Afghans together with their separation from those separations that they have. And this, you know, Afghanistan is beleaguered with warlords. These warlords are a product primarily of the guerrilla groups that fought against the Soviet Union. And each of these warlords was a leader in his or her in his region. There were no herds in those amongst the Afghan warlords. And so these warlords, after the events of 9/11, were often involved with us in going after the Taliban, and they remember, of course, that they have their own agenda, and they don't want to be deposed from being a powerful leader. And so each of them in his region continues to kind of see how he can advance his own interests and agendas. So this is contrary to centralizing Afghanistan's tenuous hold on the governmental process. Remember, Afghanistan was a stateless state for 30 years, essentially, after the Soviets invaded that country, and it was involved in some form of war, a war of liberation, a civil war, or again, a war of liberation against the Taliban, the Pakistanis, and the Al-Qaeda terrorists. And so for 30 years, people have been fighting, but they haven't been working together. So now it's important for Hamid Karzai to have as his primary objective a cobbling together of all those component parts back into a country that can work all of its citizens together for its future. So one of the things to remember is in trying to do that, we keep hearing about attacks along the border between Afghanistan and Afghanistan. Remember that the distance of that border is the same distance as the distance between Boston and Omaha, 1,500 miles. And there are about 8,000 troops trying to catch those people. Well, you know, think about spreading 8,000 troops along such a very, very long and very porous border, a border that has over 250 mountain passes through which people are very, very difficult to observe as they move, and which have been very, very instrumental in the providing with resources for the Afghans who are fighting against the Soviets. So there are a lot of people who are familiar with how to move around in there, and there are a lot of bulwarks and underground caves and bunkers set up to guard, and to protect anybody who would seek to be fighting against the governments of either Pakistan or Afghanistan. And that's what's going on. Those where those people are located, those terrorists, in combination with some of the drug lords, because you got to remember this, that the terrorists, the drug lords, and the warlords may all have different specific agendas, but all those agendas travel on parallel tracks, and that they are interested in not seeing Afghanistan's central government succeed and in not seeing the U.S. successful in what our objectives are in working with that new government of Afghanistan. And it's because they wish to see a lawless, stateless society. That's how terrorists and drug lords and warlords can best function in an environment. And I'm going to close my presentation, as I always do, with a couple of poems. Because I want you all to understand that Afghanistan, which we see all the time today in the war, in the world, I mean in the news, as a country beset by war or tragedy, is a country that is right in the middle of one of the most outstanding passages of culture in humankind's history. The language of Afghanistan, one of the primary languages, Persian, is an Indo-European language like French, Spanish, German, and Italian. And it is considered to be the richest of all of the Indo-European languages during its golden era of literature, to be the richest in poetic expression. And this one poem here that I'm going to read is the poem that's in the lobby of the United Nations section on human rights. And because people believe this is the best expression of why we need to be concerned about one another, it's called The Children of Adam. And it goes, Bani Adam azoy yaki digarand, kidar ofrinish ziyaki joharan, chu ozwe badar awarad rozgar, digar ozwara namanad karar. The children of Adam are limbs of one another, created from one essence, each from the other. When life's calamities to one cause pain, the other limbs cannot in rest remain. And then my favorite poem in any language, and the one was on the back of the program for Karzai's honorary doctorate. It's called Roses and Clay, and it's about the value of friendships. And it goes like this. Gili khushbui dar hamam rozi rasid az dasti mabubi badastam. Padu guftam ke mushki o abari ki az bui dila wizi tu mustam. Bugufta man gili na chiz budum wa lakin mudati bagul na shistam. Kamali ham nashin dar man o serkat wagana man hamon khakem ki astam. One day at Bath, a piece of perfumed clay was passed to me from the hand of a friend. I asked the clay, are you musk or ambergris, because your delightful scent intoxicates me? It answered, I am but a worthless piece of clay that has sat for a period with a rose. The perfection of that companion left its traces on me, who remains that same piece of earth that I was. So I see Gary standing there, which probably means I need to be finishing up. I'll leave to your questions, my interpretation of how well Afghanistan is moving in terms of its development and reconstruction, getting out of its very, very tragic past 30 years and rejoining the rest of the world as a member of the, real participating member of the United Nations. So with that, I'm very pleased to have been able to be here today and see so many of you whom I know, and those of you whom I don't, thank you for coming. And if you have questions, I'm always eager to respond to those.
There is paper and pencil at your table. If you have questions, please write them down, and we will have somebody pick them up. Is the Taliban reemerging as a potent force in Afghanistan?
The Taliban remain a potent force only if you look at them in terms of what they can do to disrupt the process of reconstruction. I don't think they're reemerging in any way, shape, or form as a potent political force. And I think they've lost a lot of credibility as well through their own years in power. People, may have been more conservative in their practice of religion during that time, but that's what happens in extreme periods. People tend to move more towards extremist forms of their religion. Afghans have always been conservative, but they've never been fundamentalist or extreme, and particularly in recent and modern times. But during the invasion of the Soviet Union, the occupation of the Soviet Union, Afghans were moved more towards those extreme forms of Islam. And so that's what the Taliban were able to capitalize on. But people quickly understood that they can only take so much of the church, in other words, so much of the religion. It's like everywhere else. You can take so much, and then people like to have a real separation of religion and state, or church and state. And Afghans have that real sense of that, and they're starting to feel that in their whole lifestyles. But the real problem of the Taliban is that they can disrupt the progress in Afghanistan through one, two, or three of them being a terrorist here, there, or elsewhere. And most of these bombings, et cetera, are being conducted by people not who are not Afghan, but who are part of that worldwide terrorist conglomeration.
What is the influence today of Osama bin Laden?
Well, Osama bin Laden is influential in that he is able to bring money to those who are extremists or fundamentalists who are still fighting against the Afghan central government and the American and others who are there helping them. And so if only symbolically he's influential in that way, but he's also instrumental in helping the transit of resources, particularly money, to those who need them to carry on their activities. He's not influential in a religious way, primarily because Afghans have always resented any external forces in their country. You've got to remember that they fought the British three times during the 19th and 20th centuries, and each time they defeated the British. Great stories are about the first, second, and third Anglo-Afghan wars. We've read about them mostly through Rudyard Kipling, seen them in movies like King of the Khyber Rifles and things of that nature. But Afghans have always, resented external intrusion into their lives, although they've welcomed external assistance. But one from the outside needs to understand how far and what areas one could go. And I think people see Osama bin Laden as an external force who certainly time has passed and who has probably brought more ill upon the society than good.
A related question. A U.S. government official has stated recently that he thinks he knows where bin Laden is located, but that we have to respect national boundaries. What do you think?
Well, of course, he's speaking about the boundaries of Pakistan. And so I think everybody who followed this believes that Osama bin Laden is in a part of Pakistan that is essentially around here, although others now believe he might be around there, which is farther north. So the fact of the matter is he's along that 1,500-mile border that I described as being as long as Omaha to Boston and many, many, many spots to go, and it's hard to find him. I just wish that our government could put on the same kind of deck of cards campaign that we had in Iraq going after Saddam Hussein in our efforts to go again and find people like Osama bin Laden and Mullah Muhammad Omar and Gulbuddin Hikmetyar and the others who continue to wreak havoc on the Afghan people. They're not in any way subscribing to the interests of Afghanistan.
This questioner wants to know, or wants your reaction to accusations by Nebraskans for Peace that your organization distributes textbooks in Afghanistan that promote violence.
Well, this particular question comes up on a regular basis, and it's one we respond to every time it comes up, but it comes up every year. There seems to be a cyclical history of this thing, and even though it's addressed, the fact is that during the 1980s, the mid-80s, in Pakistan, where there were something like 5 to 7 million Afghan refugees, there was an Afghan ministry in exile. We assisted that Afghan ministry in exile in printing books that they themselves had written. We were informed by our State Department, because we had a contract from the State Department to assist them, that we were not to have any input into the content, that the content belonged to them. These textbooks were the product of years and years and years of contracts funded by the U.S. government that involved University of Wyoming and then the Columbia University and the University of Nebraska at Omaha. And so those books were brought down by those who were in exile in Pakistan. And yes, they did have militant sections concerning the Soviet Union, but the Soviet Union had killed 1 million Afghans and had occupied the country, and so one might expect that the Afghans weren't going to be speaking in a kind of friendly way about these people who were occupying them. Once the Soviets left, those particular parts were taken out of their textbooks. None of the textbooks that were produced from 1989 through the current period had any of those references. And I think to keep bringing that up is taking a kind of revisionist look at history. We need to remember what the heck happened in the 80s, why it happened in the 80s, and then also understand that those things didn't occur during the 90s or in the most recent series of textbooks, which have absolutely no references of those kinds at all. And so that's what we say each year, that they bring the same topic up, but whatever their form.
Your thoughts on criticism of Hamid Karzai for not doing enough to reduce production of opium, the raw material for heroin?
Well, this is a tough process. Got to remember, the first thing that Hamid Karzai wants to do is unify his country, which has been very, very divided over the last 30 years. And he doesn't have a military sufficient to implement any kind of policy of that nature that he wishes to implement. Without Western support, he's not going to be able to do this. And you don't remove all of the income of the citizens of a country without replacing the income with something different. And I know of no real crop that can supplant the opium poppy, that can be grown as cheaply, have as many cycles of growing in a given year, and produce the dollars that does. But if one takes a look at it in a different way, in other words, attacks the idea of developing the economy of those areas, not just the agriculture, because in each plot of land, there's generally a large number of families, often the same integral nuclear family, being supported. And so maybe one person could grow the wheat there, which would be grown in as a replacement crop, but another one needs to be trained to maybe be a plumber, another one to be trained to be perhaps a trucker or a small engine repairman or something of that nature. And that's how one can contribute to the total economy, replacement economy of the opium poppy. So to ask Hamid Karzai, with the resources that he has, to remove these things, I think, you know, is a kind of act of dissembling in some ways, because you got to remember that particular criticism came up immediately after there were criticisms of the U.S. military in terms of interrogating prisoners in Afghanistan, and so that might have been a way to respond to that, because Hamid Karzai did say yes, it's necessary for those who have done those kinds of things, to at least these events should be investigated. But he also said we must make sure we do not burden all Americans with the sins of just a few. And I think, you know, it's a very major thing. 60% of the GNP of Afghanistan is generated by the opium poppy. When I lived there in the 60s and 70s, none of it was. And there were no warlords. There were no drug lords. There was no exportation of opium poppy, products. But that's all a product of these 30 years of instability and war, and it's a tremendous challenge. But you can't change it, as we've learned throughout the whole world. And we've got to remember, we are the primary customers. And unless we educate ourselves, you know, we're going to have to live with this problem. If not in Afghanistan, it'll go to some other place.
The report, later admitted to be erroneous, of the flushing of a Quran down the toilet at Guantanamo Bay caused a furor and several deaths in Afghanistan. Is anti-American sentiment growing there?
Well, I think that pro-American sentiment that existed right after 9/11 and through the first couple of years thereafter is not as high now as it was during that period, and there are a couple of reasons for that. First of all, the expectations in terms of the reconstruction, the role of the United States in reconstruction of Afghanistan, The expectations are not being met. The amount of dollars that are said to be spent in Afghanistan, when one takes a look at it, a lot of that has been spent on infrastructural development of those groups that are providing these things, and not as much spent on program as we, you know, as the Afghans would like to see spent on that. In other words, if there's $6 billion that are spent on in Afghanistan, you take a look at, you know, how many of those dollars are actually going to program. That's the thing that's really... So Afghans are starting to question these things. I think that the demonstrations that we saw as a result of these articles in Newsweek magazine are not really reflective of how Afghans feel. I think Afghans are more fearful that we're going to dump them, again, as we did dump them in 1989 when the Soviets left Afghanistan and left Afghanistan empty of any real moderating influence. And in came the extremists, the Pakistani military, Osama bin Laden, the Taliban, and the others. And so the Afghans are fearful that we're going to leave more than anything else. You heard Hamid Karzai mention when he was in Nebraska, please don't forget Afghanistan. We need you to stand with us until this war on terrorism, until we are reconstructed. The war on terrorism is over and we are reconstructed. And the best way for us to counter these kinds of demonstrations is to be more successful in the way we're doing our reconstruction. There are a lot of things that have been done and a lot of good things have been done, a lot of good ideas. But they all take time, and sometimes they were not as highly organized as they should have been, or maybe they were focused with too much money on infrastructure building and overhead and not enough on program. I think most of the people who were demonstrating were those kinds of people in that part of Afghanistan who are easily motivated to extremist philosophy. And that's because they're very, very close to the border with Pakistan. So there's a lot of movement. There were a lot of Pakistanis, for example, in those groups that were demonstrating. And there were groups that were very sympathetic to Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, one of those who is opposed to the U.S. presence in the Karzai government. So you can get out a bunch of people to demonstrate in that way. But I think, without a question, well more than 95% of the population is more fearful that the U.S. might dump them again rather than, these other concerns that have been raised.
What is your impression of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, and have they achieved any of their goals to bring equality to Afghan women?
This group of women is an advocacy group that has, I think, more than anything else, brought to the awareness of the rest of the world. And particularly that was the case immediately in the years before 9/11, and then the period immediately after 9/11, when the world was more focused on what the Afghan women had to live with in that country. So I think they have been successful in bringing attention to the plight of Afghan women. In Afghanistan, as maybe in the state of Nebraska, sometimes radical calls for change aren't always as successful as measured calls for change. I'm not saying one is right or one is wrong. I'm just saying that's a reality. This is a relatively conservative state. Maybe the adverb isn't necessary. But in any case, it's a conservative state, I think, in the main, and Afghanistan is also conservative. And so to radical calls for change oftentimes bring attention, but they don't oftentimes bring results, immediate results. But I think in the long term, in a place like Afghanistan, just by bringing attention, by having that focus, it has a long-term positive impact. And so I know many of these people, and I applaud them. Most of them, of course, live outside of Afghanistan, and they lead a life that is very different than the women inside Afghanistan. So you got to balance that when their objectives are are espoused and in terms of their capacity to provide real relief.
My Bible study group wonders why your Afghanistan department never mentions the Pashtun tribe, which is more numerous and more democratic than the others.
Well, that's not true. In fact, the Pashtuns are about 45% of the population of Afghanistan, and the non-Pashtuns are the other 55%, okay? And this is, again, a part of that whole ethnic religious differences, a set of differences that have to do with Afghanistan. The primary lingua franca of Afghanistan has always been Persian, but the language of the largest tribe, the Pashtuns, of course, is Pashto. And we have worked to do various things at our university, at the Center for Afghanistan Studies, which just haven't received as much PR as perhaps some of the other things that have been focused on Pashtuns as well. Hamid Karzai is a Pashtun. The King of Afghanistan is a Pashtun. Almost all of my closest Afghan friends, those who have worked and been the leaders of our teams in Afghanistan, are Pashtun. We also have some non-Pashtuns, but both have been addressed by us, and we will continue to do that. Our signs for Karzai were in both Pashto and Dari, and everything that we did, that we try to do in an equal way. The thing we got to remember: the Pashtuns have difficulty seeing the forest because they are the trees. Just like the non-Pashtuns have a difficulty seeing the forest because they are the trees. And so if you ask the Pashtuns, they're upset because they think we're too pro-Persian speakers. If you ask the Persian speakers, they're upset because they think we're too pro-Pashtun. And we get these same kinds of complaints on both sides all the time, and which just is, an affirmation of the fact that Afghanistan is a society with many ethnic and religious differences. And when it's trying to reconstruct, it has difficulty, its citizens do, of seeing the forest. They most often see the trees.
Time for one more question. Will Afghan forces be able to take over soon, permitting the return of U.S. troops?
They will bit by bit take over more of the duties, I guess, and maintaining the security of Afghanistan, but I don't think that will happen anytime soon. I think it's going to take this is at least a 10-year process. We're into the third year plus of the whole thing, and for us to expect that we're going to be able to win the war on terrorism in 2 or 3 years when it took us 50 years to win the Cold War, I think is not very, realistic. We had intimations that this kind of thing was coming. We didn't do a good job. Either the Clinton administration or the current administration before 9/11 in anticipating these kinds of things. So I'm saying that I'm not trying to be Democrat or Republican. It's just that we were surprised by what happened. We shouldn't have been surprised because the information was there as we learned. And that's an unfortunate situation for our country that we had to go through. But now to recreate Afghanistan so that it is able to maintain its security, we're seeing how difficult that is in Iraq, but also remember how difficult it was in Korea and after the Korean War, how much time it took us in Europe and how much time it took us in Japan and every other place where these kinds of activities have gone on. How about former Yugoslavia and the experiences there? It takes time, and we've got to understand that we need to invest our time and our money in achieving success in these because it's in the long-term interest of the United States as well as the long-term interest of Afghanistan that Afghanistan not be a haven for terrorists and drug lords, and neither should Iraq be that way, and whatever one's perception of whether or not we should be in Iraq and the way we went in or whatever, the fact is today we got a situation where if it comes up a cropper, we got a problem, and in the long term, and it's going to take a lot of effort on the part of all of us, and it may require actual taxes being you know, raised for that purpose. I know that that's anathema to the politicians of today, but that, you know, an investment in the long term in Afghanistan in 1989 may have precluded a lot of what we've had to spend in that period since, at least in that part of the world.
Just a couple of things before we conclude. The Press Club Noon Forums are available on videotape and can be purchased through CP Media. If interested, call the Press Club for details. Our thanks to our audience here at the Press Club and our KIOS radio audience, and a special thanks to Tom Goodyear for his appearance here today.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's speaker has been Thomas Goodyear, Director of Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and Dean of International Studies and Programs at UNO. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Tuesday, June 21st, 2005, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Gary Kerr for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. The Press Club will be closed in July. The next forum will be Thursday, August 25th at 12 noon. At that time, we'll hear a talk by Ted Kooser, Poet Laureate of the United States. He'll talk about his year as Poet Laureate. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.